If I'm ever famous for a quote, here's the quote I'd like to be famous for: survival is underrated. Because to lead during these kinds of challenging times, to be a pastor, I think under the ideal circumstances, is not easy. But to try to be a good pastor or Christian leader of whatever sort, paid or unpaid, is not easy. And I remember thinking as I ran around that lake that day, I am in great danger of going extinct. I'm in great danger of losing something. Around that time, one of my friends who had planted a church about the same time I did was in the process of quitting. And I'll just tell you the story briefly, but he called me one day, and we met for lunch every few months, and we're just kind of friends to each other. He called me one day and said, "I just wanted to tell you I'm going to quit tonight. I've had it. I can't take it anymore." And I knew he was very well loved by his congregation, but he had two or three elders on his board who just hated him. But his congregation loved him. And I knew that if they had the choice, they'd throw out the three elders to keep him as the pastor. And I pleaded with him. I said, "Mike, you're a good man. I said, if you quit, it's not like there's a long line of people with your gifts and skills and character and passion lined up behind you. If you quit, we're losing one of the good guys. I said, look, if you need to do it, I'll support you. But can I plead with you? I said, I think you're using a permanent solution to a temporary problem." And I prevailed upon him, and he agreed to go to his board and say, "I'm going to quit unless you give me some time off and unless we can renegotiate our contract here, not a written contract, an unwritten contract, but renegotiate to make this more sustainable." And so he did that, and over the next several months, he went through this kind of process, came back into the pulpit, went to see a counselor because he was struggling with depression, and maybe 18 months later, his counselor said to him one day, "Every month for the last 18 months, you're less healthy than you were the month before. In addition to being a pastor, you're a husband and you're a father. If you let this job continue to destroy you, you will have nothing left for your wife and children." And she said, "I recommend that you quit today." And the second time when he called me and told me, I realized it may have been a mistake for me to tell him the first time. I don't know. But I that time knew for his own good, he needed to get out. And he's a good man, and I would have no criticism of him at all. It's just that he was in a circumstance that the dynamics and the tension and the anxieties we talked about, let's be realistic. What we've talked about this morning about the need to create places to listen is incredibly important. But there are some situations where there are toxic levels of anger and fear and resentment and other issues going on that have nothing to do with you. Jesus Christ, if he were leading that congregation, would still get crucified, if I could say it that way. You know, you understand what I'm saying? The Bible doesn't give us the story of foolproof methods of leadership. And in fact, we follow someone who was misunderstood, rejected, and in one sense, didn't survive, but in another sense, of course, did. So, you know, when you think about that bird, the dodo, it went extinct. And all we have left of it are skeletons and stuffed examples to get some idea of what the dodo was like. Another case in point, some of you are familiar with the ivory-billed woodpecker, which in my entire lifetime was assumed to be extinct. I'm interested in birds, and I remember the first time I saw a pileated woodpecker, I thought, I've rediscovered the ivory-billed woodpecker. And of course, the ivory-billed woodpecker is a lot bigger. But that happened to hundreds of people. They'd report rediscovering it. And then it would always be proven to be a myth until about a year ago. And this bird that has been assumed to be extinct for decades was discovered. It's still alive. And some of you might think this is really strange, but for those of us who are into the outdoors, when I read the article about the ivory-billed woodpecker still being alive, I started to cry. It was like, it was like, wow, what happened? But it's very moving to think that something that's lost forever could be still there. I mean, what a bad stuffing job of that bird. So maybe they'll still go extinct because there are very few, but they rediscovered down in the pine forests of Louisiana at least one pair that's still alive. And I haven't seen any photographs yet, although this is a good painting of one. I saw this cartoon. I have privacy issues, says Bird. I don't want to go to no stinking zoo. And this idea of surviving, but not surviving in a zoo or in a cage, but actually being alive and wild and free and all the rest, I think this is part of the struggle that we feel as leaders in these times. So I'd like to just share with you a list of things. This is a little bit on the level of a self-help tape. But I think that if the church is going to get through this transition, it's going to require leaders who don't go extinct in the process. And sometimes I think that the only hope is, sometimes I think that Europe is actually in a great position, that the old colonial Roman form of Christianity has to die out so that there can be a resurrection. Sometimes I think that's maybe the best thing. It sounds terrible to say that. But I hope that what can happen here in our country and in other places in the world represented by people in this room is I hope that we can survive, but that we can survive in a healthy and productive way. And so I'd like to share with you a couple of things that I think have helped me from that day learn to some degree to be a friend to myself, not in a narcissistic, self-indulgent way, hopefully, but in a way that will keep, that I wouldn't be blamed for my own extinction. And the first is just learning to acknowledge the pain that this brings to us, to ourselves and to God. I think we've talked about that a good bit, but can we speak of it on very personal levels for each of us as an individual? Especially those of you who are somewhere close to my age, let's say between 35 and 55, if you have grown up in the era of the church growth movement, one of the hazards of ministry in these years is the assumption that anybody who is worth anything would grow a church to thousands of people, and that there's something wrong with you. You don't have the gift of leadership or whatever else if you don't have churches of thousands. And there is a certain kind of self-hatred that I think is very pervasive among leaders. It's an unintended consequence of the church growth movement. And I remember one of my best friends who has since left ministry and gone through a marriage or two and one of those sad stories, but one of the most gifted pastors I've ever known. I remember he said to me one day when we were talking, he said, "I'm into this for the fame." And he said, "I know God's going to get me. He won't let me get away with it. But my ego is way too much part of this." He said this to me. And of course, and in a certain sense, he was saying it like, not like I need to repent. It was like, I'm out of control. And this is what it's about. All that stuff, there's pain in facing those things. And there's pain in letting go of visions or delusions of grandeur and all that sort of thing. There's a lot of pain that we have to accept. But I think the truth is we're way better off accepting it and acknowledging to ourselves and acknowledging it to God. And of course, the Bible gives us so much permission in this, so much permission to be honest and to rage and vent and unload and just to pour it all out before God. I remember I had a disturbing experience. I can't go into too much detail, but I was in Europe, and I was with a well-known leader in the charismatic movement, and he and I were driving somewhere, and the entire drive, about an hour and 15-minute drive, he was making fun of the charismatic movement, which if you've been in, you know, the charismatic movement, there's a lot to, you know, there's a lot of funny stuff, and he was making fun of a lot of things. And it was clear he was deeply cynical. Then when we got to church, he stepped into the pulpit and went right into the show. And I remember thinking, how can these two things exist in one person? And then after church, it was back to the same. And he's trying to survive. I'm not criticizing him. But that sort of thing, that kind of cognitive dissonance, there's pain there that has to be faced. And this is not meant as a criticism of him. He's in the process of dealing with it. But maybe I saw myself in some ways in that. I think there are times where we just feel what we're standing up to is absolutely impossible, and we're going to get flattened. And I remember feeling this. I was speaking at some convention, and there was a question late, you know, in one of these Q&A sessions. What would you recommend to a 22-year-old person who's just beginning seminary like myself and wants to make a difference in the emerging culture? And the first word that came to my mind was, run! You know, because there's a certain sense, none of this is going to be easy. My friend who dropped out finally of ministry said, you know what? Life is hard enough, but a lot of us baby boomers assumed it was supposed to be easy. So we have the double problem of the hardness of life and the disillusionment that it was supposed to be easy. And how many of our sermons are telling people how we can make life easy and all the rest, the five steps or whatever. Now, closely related to this acknowledging the pain to ourselves is to find some non-utilitarian friends. When I say non-utilitarian, this is not as easy as it sounds, and maybe there is no such thing as a purely non-utilitarian friendship. But to be able to find some friends who don't need you to succeed or who have nothing to gain by you failing, to find some friends who maybe pay you that enormously rich gift of just liking you, who you don't have to perform for, who would like you no matter what. A friend of mine has taught me so much about this. He's one of my mentors. When I met him, I was about 25 and he was about 45, and so now I'm 50 and he's 70. And I've learned an awful lot from him. But he signs all of his emails to me FNMW, which means friends no matter what. It's an incredibly precious thing. And those of us who are leading in these times, we really need some FNMWs. Tim Keel, who is here, is the guy who I first heard use the word generative friendship, the kind of friendships that when you get together, it's not one person being a parasite off the other. It's two people who, or three or however many, but when you're together, you all go away feeling a little bit fuller. And you're interested in one another's life and success, not just your own. It's a rich thing. I think I'm an old guy of the 70s, you know, but Jackson Browne had a great song, some of you might remember, called The Late Show. Everyone I've ever known has wished me well. Anyway, that's how it seems. It's hard to tell. Maybe people only ask you how you're doing, because that's easier than letting on how little they could care. But when you know that you've got a real friend somewhere, somehow, suddenly all the others are so much easier to bear. And I don't know where we get friends like that. I think we pray for them. I think we find them. And I think probably if we manifest the right kind of friendliness, eventually they'll come to us. But many of us in ministry, it's one of our dysfunctions. We're so used to being caretakers and martyrs in some way that we almost make it impossible for people to be reciprocal in this way. And that's not their fault. And it can make us bitter because we don't realize the way we're sabotaging ourselves. And I've struggled with that through the years, but I've learned that a big part of it is when we take the risk of admitting our failures and our faults and our doubts and our questions, and the other person doesn't try to fix us or recoil or put us on a prayer list. You understand what I mean? That is a sign we found one of those friends. Third would be related to this. I mean, in this sense, we're saying I just need some friends. But here, give yourself permission to create or find safe places. Now, first of all, there is no such thing as a perfectly safe place. Places are more or less safe. But I think in this world, there are no purely safe places. Let's get out of that naivete. But there are somewhat safe places and where we have boundaries for protection from toxic people and situations, and we have time and social space to think. And that's what these days are for us. And this is why I think Alan and Pat and Sarah Jane and the others who've organized this time have worked hard to just say the main thing happening here is not taking notes and getting ideas and finding solutions. There is something about just taking the time out to think and talk and marinate and let things settle in. The social scientists call plausibility structures, to realize that thinking itself is a social act. And I want to try to picture this by saying, imagine that you belong to a community that has certain boundaries of the way they think, and you start to expand those boundaries. I know this is a circle and not a box, but you begin thinking outside the box, so to speak, or thinking outside the circle. And eventually you think a little farther outside the circle. And eventually you think a little farther outside the circle. There comes a point, the farther outside the circle I have found, the harder it is to think. And eventually my mind just won't think anymore. Unless I can find some other people who will join me in my thinking, I can't think anymore. I don't know how to explain it. But it is, I think, a reality. In fact, it's sort of hidden in the word consciousness, to know with. And there's some way that we can't think or know without other people to think and know with us. It's interesting. You know, there are wonderful stories at the emergence of the new science of Albert Einstein and Werner Heisenberg and Niels Bohr and Max Planck and all these great minds who would meet up in Berlin or in London or in Geneva or wherever there was a scientific conference. They'd meet up and they would just talk about how their findings didn't fit in with Newtonian science. And they didn't have it figured out, but they needed people to talk about the fact that it doesn't fit, who had some inkling of what they're talking about. And that's why a gathering like this is so important. But if people in your primary community of belonging don't eventually give you space, what very often happens is you have to go join another community of belonging where your thinking will be permissible. And this is the way Protestants have tended to work. You can think outside the circle to a certain point, but then you're jettisoned and forced to either form or find a new community. Now, I think there's another possibility, and that is that this process would continue and that eventually there would be a kind of center of gravity shifting, and then, in a sense, the organization itself would accommodate the thinking that you're part of. And that would make possible perhaps more thinking. But let's be realistic. What often happens after that is there's a counter-reaction and a counter-movement forms. And I wish we could be exempt from some of these kinds of things, but I just don't think you can. And so you're left with hard choices. And I think every one of us is in settings where these dynamics are at play. And I think we have to tell ourselves, it's not your fault. This is one of the ways you're a friend to yourself. You're part of a group, you're part of history, you're part of sociology, and that's where we live. I mean, this is the book of Acts. And this is Protestant history in a lot of different ways. Number four would be, know what recharges you and do it religiously, because it's truly a religious act. Beauty, laughter, rest, sport, art, whatever it is. I am so lucky. I'm just so lucky, and I'm so blessed that I have things in my life that recharge me, and I know they recharge me, and I know that some people don't. And to me, this is like such an important investment to try to find the things that recharge you, and know what they are, and segment them off from work. One of the worst things you can do is find that you always get paid for the things that recharge you. I have a friend who was a violin student. She was a great violin player, getting I can't remember if it was a master's, MFA. I think she'd already gotten her MFA. She was going on for more advanced study. And when I saw her once, she said that she'd quit studying violin. She said, because the more I studied it, the less I enjoyed it. And violin is too important. So she said, I changed. I've gone back to school. I'm getting a master's in reading. And so I'm going to teach reading. I don't ever read anymore, but I love to play the violin. To realize that ministry is not life, my friend Rob Bell says, you've got to smoke what you're selling. And what he means by this, some of you won't understand this and you can be glad, but what he means by this is that if we go around preaching the abundant life and all we do is work, then we are not an example of what we're preaching. Do you understand? And this is another way of saying that workaholism is not only unhealthy, but in a certain sense, it's a denial of the good news that we preach, that Jesus came so that we could have life and life abundant. Dallas Willard showed me this little diagram once to say that your job is a small part of your ministry, and a ministry is a small part of your life. So I love the outdoors. I just love the outdoors. It recharges me. And so whenever I enjoy the outdoors, that's part of my life. And I love God when I am enjoying the outdoors. And I love live music. I was in Europe recently, and I saw a guy playing the accordion on the street, and I was entranced. I mean, I never knew I liked the accordion, but make it live on the street. I just love live music. When I'm doing that, I'm alive. It's part of my life. And I think we need our ministry to be bigger than our job. And some of those annoying interruptions that come our way are actually opportunities to have ministry that we're not getting paid for. And that's pretty important for us, to have ministry that actually is a secret that nobody knows about, where we're doing things for nothing. Fifth would be to communicate clearly and redundantly and wisely. This is the only professional thing I'm going to say. Everything else is more personal, but this is part of being a friend of myself. I have learned that I either invest the effort on the front end in communication or I pay for it later on in trouble. And I heard a Baptist guy say this. I think this is really good. He said, even when if you aren't certain, you can be clear. And what he means by this is that, you could say to your congregation, I am not certain of the way we should go. But I know that this is something that we can work on and grapple with together. See, if you just say, I don't know what to do, then your congregation is afraid and the anxiety level in your organization rises, and then there are letters circulating around behind your back about the need for you to be called elsewhere. But if you can reduce that ambiguity with enough clear communication, that then their anxiety goes down. I think that is a way that we save ourselves trouble. I don't know where I heard this, but it has proven to be so true. In the absence of communication, organizations burn trust. And so I think in times of change, we have to find ways to communicate. Now, that doesn't mean what some people think. For example, one of the ways we have to learn to communicate is to not answer badly framed questions. This is something Jesus would not do. And some of you know I've taken a lot of heat because it's widely known that I'm evasive and cowardly and I won't say what I think. Where the truth is, I just know that some questions are badly framed and I don't want to be part of answering the question because I think it's a stupid question. It's a badly framed question and there's a no-win solution to it. This is what Jesus did. He either reframed them or he somehow deconstructed them by turning them back on the askers. But instead of worrying always of being in the defensive about answering other people's badly framed questions, part of our clear communication is to keep throwing out the questions that we think need to be raised. I felt pretty good about this recently because some of you know there's a conservative theological journal that did a whole thing largely on me and a couple friends of mine. And there was an interview that was done. It was very fair. It was done very, very fair. But what I really felt great about in the interview is they wanted to talk about epistemology and they wanted to talk about absolute truth and all this sort of thing. And I felt really great that in the interview, I got to raise questions about power and militarism and the religious right and the Republican Party and all that sort of thing. And I just felt great about that, that I wasn't being put on a microscope to be dissected by someone else. I was getting a chance to be a leader. And I found that as a person with a gift of leadership, to whatever small degree I have it, or a calling for it, or an accidental duty of it, or whatever it is, I hate being a leader when my job becomes fulfilling other people's expectations. I love being a leader when I get to set some expectations. And so, and one last thing, when it comes to these times, if you're going to lead in these circumstances, there is no way to do it without conflict. I have never regretted being kind, and I can think of a time I have not regretted when I've been harsh or defensive or sarcastic or whatever else. Because when I do that, I'm pumping more toxins into the system, and I have to live in that system with the toxins I just pumped in. And I just want to share something that has helped me. I was just sharing this with someone yesterday, but something that has helped me in this last couple of years, in whatever way I have been, you know, I mean, I'm sure a lot of my controversy is my own fault, but in whatever way this is necessary to lead in these times of transition. Somebody sent me a prayer by Bishop Nikolai Velimirovich, and he was a Serbian bishop who spoke out against Nazism and was arrested and was taken to Dachau. And I'm not certain whether what was the cause of this, but as I understand it, when he was in Dachau, here he is a bishop, and he feels filled with hatred. And I don't know if it was toward the Nazis or if it was toward his fellow priests who betrayed him to the Nazis. For whatever reason, he was really filled with pain. And out of that came a prayer. And the prayer is too long for me to share the whole thing. I'll just share a couple of stanzas of it. But this prayer has helped me. It has been one of the most significant pieces of literature I've ever come across. It goes, "Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless them and do not curse them. Enemies have driven me into your embrace more than friends have. Just as a hunted animal finds safer shelter than an unhunted animal does, so have I, persecuted by enemies, found the safest sanctuary, having ensconced myself beneath your tabernacle, where neither friends nor enemies can slay my soul. Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless and do not curse them. They, rather than I, have confessed my sins before the world. They have punished me whenever I have hesitated to punish myself. They have tormented me whenever I have tried to flee torments. They have scolded me whenever I have flattered myself. They have spat upon me whenever I have filled myself with arrogance. Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless and do not curse them. Whenever I have made myself wise, they've called me foolish. Whenever I've made myself mighty, they have mocked me as though I were a fly. Whenever I've wanted to lead people, they've shoved me into the background. Whenever I've rushed to enrich myself, they've prevented me with an iron hand. Whenever I thought that I would sleep peacefully, they have wakened me from sleep. Whenever I've tried to build a home for a long and tranquil life, they've demolished it and driven me out. Truly, enemies have cut me loose from the world and have stretched out my hands to the hem of your garment. Bless my enemies, O Lord. Even I bless and do not curse them. Bless them and multiply them. Multiply them and make them even more bitterly against me." That was the hardest part of this for me to pray. "So that my heart may become the grave of my two evil twins, arrogance and anger. So that I might amass all my treasure in heaven. Ah, so that I may for once be freed from self-deception, which has entangled me in the dreadful web of illusory life. Enemies have taught me to know what hardly anyone knows, that a person has no enemies in the world except himself. One hates his enemies only when he fails to realize that they are not enemies but cruel friends. It is truly difficult for me to say who has done me more good and who has done me more evil in the world, friends or enemies. Therefore, O Lord, bless both my friends and my enemies." And therefore, a man who understands, he says, freely steps among them and prays to God for them. "Bless my enemies, O Lord, even I bless them, and do not curse them." And that's at my website if you want to get a copy of that. But that has done me more good than I can possibly explain. And I think there's a degree to which, if we're going to be friends to ourselves and venture out into this kind of territory, we have to believe that there will be plenty of counterattacks. I just need to finish up because our time's almost up. Six is just, I put this six because to put it first or last just didn't seem right. So this is just sort of in the middle. Lean into God. Believe that God is for you. Stay in touch with God, even in doubt, and maintain your first order disciplines. A friend of mine helped me with this terminology. He said a first order discipline is to pray. A second order discipline is to have a theology of prayer. A first order discipline is to give to the poor. A second order discipline is to have a theology of economics or an economic philosophy. A first order discipline is to reconcile with your enemies. A second order discipline is to argue determining whether you or your enemies are right. You understand the difference? And I have found in this transition, all of my problems are on the second level, and or second order. And they always tempt me to stop doing the first order. But I've found that if I stay with the first order, I'll get through the instability on the second order. A lot more we could say about that. Admit what you must do, number seven, and what you cannot do. Isn't it interesting, Martin Luther's language, when he stands before the Diet of Worms, I cannot, I will not recant. And I find so often that I, in conflict, I have people asking me to do things that I simply cannot do. If you want to read a poem that expresses this, go online and look up a poem by E.E. Cummings called I Sing of Olaf. And I can't repeat it here, but it's a great poem. But there's a certain sense that, I cannot live with a theology that justifies genocide. I cannot live with a theology that can be used to justify destroying human beings. And you might require me to, and I'll just have to respectfully say, I cannot. I will not. Whatever you believe about homosexuality, once you know a lot of homosexual people, you cannot live in a way that destroys them. See, whatever your theology is of it, and you have to reach the points where you say, I understand you're requiring me to do this. I understand you will reject me unless I do this. I'm sorry, I cannot, and I will not. I think part of being a friend to yourself is giving yourself permission to have integrity, even when it's misunderstood. If some people will not hear you or will not allow you to have a voice, that may constitute your call to go to other people, people who may be dying for the chance to enter into conversation with you. I think this was there in the Luke passage we've read. It's part of dusting shaking the dust off your feet. It's saying, don't waste your time. And I want to say this. This needs to be said. There are so many people who, because in the anxiety of our church communities, they're saying, go slower. We can only handle so much. Slow down, slow down. That's true. And those are generally the only voices we hear. But I'll tell you what my kids, who are from 19 to 26, are saying. They're saying, will you please speed this thing up? Because we can't stand to be associated with this other stuff. And we need options out there. And there's an awful lot of that rising tide. And I don't know how that works out. But in these times of transition, we have to hear the pain on both sides because it's all there. Eighth would be allow yourself to be human boldly. Admit that we have strengths and weaknesses. We need work and we need rest. There's intensity and latency, public and private. One of the things that we have to be very sensitive to in times of stress is ways that sexuality can self-destroy us. Because, in a way, sexuality, to me, there are two drugs that are so accessible to people all the time. You don't have to sneak out to an alley and buy crack or whatever, because there are two drugs we have with us all the time. One of them is the drug of sex, and the other is the drug of stress. And learning to be drug-free means, I think, learning to be healthy in terms of sex and in terms of rest. And that's not easy. I'm 50 years old. I would have thought by now I would have figured out how to handle myself as a sexual being. But I think part of what it means to be a friend to yourself is to just say, no, that's something we always struggle with, how to deal with our sexuality, but how to not deny it in such a way that it ends up destroying us, or how to end up not being becoming addicted to a certain kind of drug. And, of course, the same applies to work and rest. One of my mentors said to me, in your 20s, you think you can be good at anything. In your 30s, you develop strengths and you bolster your weaknesses. But by the end of your 30s, you realize you'll never be good at some things. So you spend your 40s trying to get out of doing the things you're not good at, so that in your 50s and beyond, you can focus on what you're best at. And that has proven pretty true for my life. And part of this is being allowing yourself to be a human being. Your church might want you to be good at everything, but in so doing, they're not being your friend. And for you to side with them and say, I can be good at everything, you're not being your friend either. A special note to men on this, because especially for you younger guys, I think there's something for men in their 30s where that's the decade in our culture where men have to prove that they're really something big, you know? And that's the era of needing big numbers and needing all the rest. And one of the things that I think there are a lot of mega church pastors out there who in a certain sense sold their soul in their 30s and maybe their 40s, and by the time they get what they always wanted, they find out that it's not that great. And I think there's a struggle. I think it's part of being a human being. Being a friend to yourself, especially in your 30s, you need some things you can succeed at and feel good about. I remember I went to see a counselor in the middle of some of my struggles. I was 38 years old. I went to see a counselor, and I was thinking about quitting ministry, and she said, well, what would you do? I said, this sounds crazy. I said, but I'd quit, and I'd make as much money as I can. I said, the funny thing is, I don't really like money, and I don't need anything. I don't have anything, like, I don't have a list of things I do with the money. I don't even think I like money that much. So I don't even know why, but that's my fantasy. And she says, oh, it makes perfect sense to me, because ministry doesn't allow men to count anything as victory. It's hard to count, and money is easy to count, she said. And so I remember leaving there thinking, that's my problem. It's okay to need to succeed and make my mark. That's part of being a human being. But I've got to be sure what I value and what I think is worth counting. And I think, and of course, I can't claim to be able to offer any deep insights for women, but I do want to say for women who are struggling with this, the leadership of women is so incredibly important at this time. Amen? It is so important. I don't think we can get where we need to go with only men leading, nor with only white people or people from the northern hemisphere, so to speak. I think where we're going, we have to go together. The problem is, in evangelical churches in the U.S., 95% of the leaders are men, and if you think it's a lot better in the mainline, I've got bad news, 85% of leaders in mainline churches are men. So the struggle and challenge for women is having so much, it's just very hard to have a voice. And especially have a voice where you feel you're being true to who you are as a human being and as a woman. And of course, there's a lot of this that works that will allow women to lead if they act like men or whatever. And I'm not that I even think there is such a thing as acting like men, but you know what I mean. I spoke somewhere once, and this woman came up to me afterwards, and she said, I don't know how you do it. She said, I don't know how you take all this criticism. I don't know how you stand up to it and all the rest. And I said, well, it's, you know, sometimes it's not that much fun. I said, but it's interesting that you're so sympathetic. I said, it sounds like you have some pain with this in your life. And she started to cry. And she couldn't talk. And I said, I think your situation is much harder than mine. Because when people criticize me, it shows that they're taking me seriously. But they don't even listen to you, do they? And she said, I have no voice in my church. And I said, it's much worse to be given no voice than to be given a voice and be attacked, you see. I just think all of the people of male persuasion here, one of the things we have to do is just, we have to help our sisters. And of course, this goes beyond gender, and then it goes to racial issues, and it goes to making sure that all of the minority communities around us are given voice. And you know what? The big thing is to be listened. That all we've said about these days, we have to listen, and we have to listen to people who've been not listened to for very long, and some of them have just gotten used to never being asked their opinion. And we have to, this listening becomes so important. And there's so much more we could say about this, but being a friend to yourself means acknowledging your gender and your racial identity and everything else too. And other people might not do it for you. You have to do it for yourself. I'm almost done. Number nine, I'm sorry I'm going long here, but I would say number nine is to spend time, intelligence, money, and energy. This is my little formula, T-I-M-E. If you want to get anything done, it will take a certain amount of time, intelligence, money, and energy. If you're low on time, it will take more intelligence, money, or energy. If you're low on intelligence, it will take a lot more time, money, and energy, and so on. And the fact is, you're going to have to spend this. And I think we have to say, if we are the kind of leaders who are trying to help our churches and our world move through these transitions, you have to invest in your own professional development. And you have to say, and I don't mean this in sort of a self-helpy, narcissistic way, but you have to say that you're worth it and the mission you're involved in is worth it. And that means spend money on consultants and coaches and counseling and whatever else you need that will help you as a person, and spend money on good books and spend money on conferences. You know, things like this are important. And also spend money on vacations, because I think when you're dealing with a high stress situation, you need time to relax. And then let me close by saying, you don't have to do this. You know, none of us should feel trapped into leading in these transition times. You don't have to do this. I don't mean this in a cynical way, but there are a lot of churches that would be very happy for you to come and help, just bless them. They need to be blessed. That's okay. That's not a sin. But if you're going to lead in this transition, you're needed, and it can be a great adventure. And if my best friend could handle it, I would hope that they would be able to hang in there. And I would wish this on my best friend, if my best friend was called and gifted for that. Challenging times can destroy us, or they can elicit from us actions and virtues we didn't know we were capable of, because we only find out that all things are possible when we feel we're in the middle of the impossible. And I want to just close. Remember I showed you those pictures of the turtle. I'd like to show you another turtle picture. I'm sure a lot of you have heard about this. You heard about what happened with the tsunami in 2004. And in Kenya, when the tsunami hit the east coast of Kenya, it went up a river near Mombasa, and the surge of water picked up a mother hippo and a baby hippo, and it pulled them out to sea. The mother drowned, and the baby somehow was washed up onto the shore. And so some people found the baby hippo, and they took it to a local zoo. And they didn't have room for the hippo, so they stuck it in a pen with a giant Seychelles Island tortoise, a male tortoise 100 years old or more. And the hippo needed a mother figure and bonded to the tortoise. And you can sort of see the color and rough shape are right, although the size is wrong. And so this little baby hippo that they named Owen develops this bond with this tortoise. Now that, in a certain sense, isn't that surprising. It's under a year old. It needs a mother. What is surprising is that the tortoise started to seem to, as much as you can interpret this, enjoy the hippo's company as well. And they develop this strange interspecific friendship. Wherever the tortoise goes, the hippo is sure to follow. And there seems to be a mutual bond. Now, if you know anything about reptiles, they aren't terribly friendly creatures. You know, they're pretty self-contained. But apparently there is something latent in that reptilian brain that is capable of more than people normally see. And the need and affection of this hippo elicited from this tortoise something you never would have expected, something you might even say is impossible. And I think that's our hope, of not only what can happen to our churches, but actually what could happen to us. Thank you.